from the air, by photography, by air surveillance, by overflights from satellites. So right now, one could manage that situation. But not after those multiple warheads come in. There's no way in the world to know how many warheads a missile has except on-site inspection. You have to be there to count them. And neither nation will permit that. And so it becomes critical now that we not go in for those multiple warheads. As this issue arises, we already have them. What was spoken of in the Senate as a well-kept secret, well-kept from the great bulk of the senators, so far as I know, was broken about 3 months ago to tell us that already the majority of our nuclear submarines, the Polaris submarines, have not the MIRV, but the MRV. The MRV is a multiple reentry vehicle. It means a lot of warheads in place of one, but not independently targetable. That is, a lot of warheads coming as a cluster. You know, this is all so crazy because the whole point of MRVs is to make ABMs useless. And we're having both. And so are the Russians. They call their MRV an SS-9. Have you been hearing about the SS-9? And how we had to get ready for the SS-9? We've been getting ready for the last 6 years. A well-guarded secret, even from senators. We've got them. They've got them. Now for the MIRV. This is just mad. The present stockpiles of nuclear weapons, as of a year ago in the Soviet Union and here, had reached the explosive equivalent of 15 tons of TNT for every man, woman, and child on the earth. The Pentagon estimates of what they call a full-scale nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. We're all for international exchanges. This is one kind. Pentagon estimates prepared by General Starbird, a lovely name, about a year ago, was that a full-scale nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union would kill. He estimated about 120 million Americans, perhaps in an hour. That's nothing to worry about. We could simultaneously kill 140 million Russians. And now, the plan is, by turning all the single nuclear warheads into multiple warheads in the next few years, and we've started, and they've started, the hope is, by the mid-1970s, for both the Soviet Union and we, to have gone through what's spoken of fondly as a controlled escalation. We expect to multiply our nuclear warheads by that time by approximately 5. You know, there's some trouble with that. There aren't that many Russians. Why do we do it? Why do we go through such an insane performance? think it does any good to say it's insane? Think it's any good to chant hymns of peace and light candles and so on? Do all those things. Please go on doing all those things. But why do you suppose we're doing this? I think I know. The present estimate. And you know what happens to these estimates. But the present estimate is that the MIRV is worth $17 billion in defense contracts. $7 billion to MIRV up the Poseidon missiles on the nuclear submarines. And $10 billion more to do that job with our land-based ICBMs, land-based missiles. We've got a defense budget of $80 billion. Secretary Laird lately declared that though it hurts, though it will get in the way of our defense posture, he's going to respond to congressional pressure by cutting the defense budget by $3 billion, from $80 billion to $77 billion. A big deal. How's he going to do that? Well, he's told us. He's going to cut the armed forces by 100,000 men. He's going to cut the civilian forces in the Defense Department by 50,000 men. He's going to put 100 warships into mothballs. But there's something he's not going to do. He's not going to interfere with any ongoing defense contract. I'm afraid that's what it's about. And I'm afraid that until you know what it's about, you can't begin to cope with it. I'm not sure you can when you do, but you might as well know what you're up against. About a week ago, my wife bought me one of the most interesting books I've seen lately. It's a little paperback written by Juan Bosch. Juan Bosch, former president of the Dominican Republic, and he, I think, would be president of the Dominican Republic right now if the Marines hadn't moved in. But he's written a little book called Pentagonism. It's very exciting. And I think very important. I'll tell you what he's saying. You see all those militant kids on the campuses. Those excited, militant people who were just rampaging in Chicago. They talk a lot about American imperialism. Juan Bosch says that imperialism is as dead as a doornail. There's something ever so much better that's taken its place. He calls that new thing Pentagonism. Let me tell you how it works. He got me all excited and I started looking up some data. Tell you all about it. You see, let's think imperialism for a moment. In imperialism, a country like ours would move into some place like South Vietnam. And we'd be good imperialists. what would we do? We'd exploit that place. We'd wring it dry. We'd get all the profits out of it one could. That's what we have to talk about. The gross national product of South Vietnam is $2.4 billion. The gross national product of all of Southeast Asia, South Vietnam, North Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, I've left one out, Thailand, all together, the gross national product is $10.2 billion. Ladies and gentlemen, that's peanuts. If you took everything there was in the country, if you left nothing behind, if you went off with a whole gross national product, that's peanuts. That's not the way to make money. I'll tell you the way to make money. Use South Vietnam as a dumping ground for expensive hardware. Right now, my friend and colleague and ex-President Eisenhower's science advisor, professor of chemistry at Harvard, George Kiszkiewicz, tells me we've got $20 billion worth of military hardware in South Vietnam. We don't want to make money out of the South Vietnamese. They don't have it. That stuff has all been bought and paid for already by us. We have the money. And we're paying the bill. And the only problem is to dump that stuff somewhere so that we can buy some more. Doesn't all have to be dumped in South Vietnam. We're dumping a lot of it here. Secretary Laird's working hard on that $3 billion. And he announced about 3 days ago another way he was going to save our money. His announcement had what was a new verb in the English language for me, to sideline. He was sidelining, he announced, 88 B-58 bombers. Those B-58 bombers are the latest thing. They're supersonic heavy bombers. They've never been used. Into the junk pile with them to save maintenance money. Several $1 billion worth of stuff. Look back and see what was being said about our need for it. Into the junk pile with it. The other day I was asked to meet at lunch with the fellows of the Kennedy School at Harvard University, the Kennedy School of Government. And it was sort of an interesting discussion. It was a mixed bag, as you might expect. It ended with a group of about a dozen people sitting around a table and continuing to talk. Three of them were German. They were German fellows at the Kennedy School. And then one of them said to me, "You know, I have not wanted to say it before, but We Germans think it is very strange that the United States of America is renting out mercenary armies. I said, what? What do you mean? Oh, he said, you know, we Germans need an army, and we rent one from you, and we pay for it by buying fantastic amounts of armaments which we do not wish to have, which we do not see any use for, and which we simply stockpile as we purchase it. That's happening all over the world. Part of Governor Rockefeller's plan, as he's just told us, for Latin America, is to supply them with arms. It's happening all over the world. Armaments is now the biggest business in America, by far. It is by far the biggest business in the world. All of this threatens our lives. All of this is closing off life for our young people. They don't see much light or life ahead. And this has also done something dreadful to the American labor movement. People who are interested in liberal causes have ordinarily found the workers their strongest support. If organized labor begins instead to find its aspirations in war, in the military, in armaments, that's very dangerous.
WBAI New York.
In a democracy, I think the most serious threat to American democracy right now is the present position of the leadership of the AFL-CIO. Any of you who has friends as I do, I have indeed a wife from this source, who were refugees from Nazism. You talk to them, you'll find that if you talk about these things with them, a sort of dazed look coming into their eyes, the dazed look of a person who has gone to the movies and is beginning to realize that he saw the film before. It's very serious. I wouldn't dream of saying things like this if I thought this were a little private paranoia. It's deadly serious. And now I'll finish with something else practical to say. You get enough idealism from other sources, I think. Let me be practical. You see, this is the biggest business in the world we're talking about. What's it doing to American business? That's what American businessmen need to worry about. And that's what American working men need to worry about. Maybe you can help to wake them up. Because I want to tell you about that. When I first heard what I'm going to say, I found it so overwhelming that I promptly began checking it up. Been checking up on it ever since. I wish it weren't too. But I'm afraid it is, well as I can gather, perfectly true, and well understood. You see, what happened after World War II is that we forbade the production of armaments to two of the most highly industrialized, most expert, and most frugal countries in the world, Germany and Japan. And having been forbidden to make armaments, they threw all their energies into civilian production. And we helped. Our industry helped. With government encouragement, our industries all established subsidiaries and taught them everything we know. All that great American know-how that one waves around in the breeze. Everything we know. Then we went on and made armaments. And they made civilian goods. A few years ago, President Johnson surprised this country a little bit by announcing that we had a negative balance of trade. In the previous year, we had imported more than we had exported. That was strange news, and he promptly said that American tourists had to spend less money, could bring in less stuff duty-free and all those other things, but we were all good patriotic Americans, and except for sneaking a few things in on the side, why we were glad to cooperate with the president, realizing that this was a little aberration that a few adjustments would soon repair. Ladies and gentlemen, we still have a negative balance of trade, and it's growing more negative all the time. And I heard a very lucid and expert discussion a little while ago that assured that audience that within another 10 years, every country in the world would recognize that the United States was now a big importing nation. The truth of the matter is that we've been pushed out of every market now, every civilian market, except for two things, aircraft and computers. Everything made of steel. Japan can do it better and more cheaply. Including cars. Japan makes more ships than the whole rest of the world put together. Cameras. Field glasses. Radios. Transistor sets, motorcycles, and Germany. All those things in Germany, too. American working men had better wake up. American prosperity's going down the drain. And what we'll be left with is ABM, MIRV, MRV, and thank heavens, a brand new supersonic bomber.
What can we do about it?
Here it comes. Here it comes. Well, that's what I spent the rest of this day on, and I can only tell you what my hopes are. But let me just say, I think that we have not just the Vietnam War in mind, not just disarmament, not just coping with this enormous arms program and the draft and all that. There's a whole package of do's and don'ts. There's a whole package of things that we have to stop doing and other things we have to begin to do. And I came to Washington today with what was for me the strangest opportunity of my life to speak to some senators. And I was trying to tell them that as I go about the country and I teach 350 freshmen and sophomores at Harvard, and I'm living my life pretty much among students and at home with my family where there are two small children. I was trying to tell them that all over the country, as I talk with students, they express a kind of despair, hopelessness. And they're always asking me, you know, isn't it hopeless? What hope is there? What hope do you see? What is there can be done? And I've been trying to say to them, among all the institutional forms of government that we now possess, one of them is, in a way, our last hope, and that's the Congress. We've lost the administration. The Supreme Court may be going down the drain. I hope not, but it may. That leaves us with the Congress. And I began to take heart a few months ago as that great ABM debate gathered force. And please do understand, the ABM is real and important in its reality, but it's even more important as a symbol, a symbolic issue. Senator Charles Percy, Republican of Illinois, put the matter very well when he said early on in the debate, "The president, the country, and the world are watching to see whether it is possible to block an arms program. Answer, not yet." That's what the ABM debate was about. And if it had won by one vote instead of losing by one vote, we'd be living in a different country now. A beginning would have been made. No beginning has been made. That whole arms procurement business went down in a complete capitulation. Just folded up. And yet, something new had appeared on the American political scene. It was a new coalition of liberal Republicans and Democrats, mainly in the Senate. That coalition came within one vote of winning that ABM fight. And that coalition seemed full of hope to me. And I was trying to say today, you see, American politics is used to dealing in men rather than issues. Men rather than issues. There is no man on the present American political scene who means anything much to my students or means all that much to me. It's the issues that matter to me and to them. And I was saying to those senators, if that liberal coalition could only bring itself to bring before the country that whole package of issues, you all know, I hope, what I'm talking about.